This is Our Voices. I'm Mario Trimble. In order to be a place where everyone in our community feels valued and connected, we first have to ensure everyone believes they belong. These are Our Voices, a joint podcast production from the Colorado and Denver Bar Association's Equity, Diversity, and Inclusivity Joint Steering Committee. Our Voices shines a light on the unique stories, experiences, and backgrounds of our member leaders so that we can help each other walk together. Over her nearly 20-year career so far, Rachel Catt has built a thriving legal practice as a family law attorney, representing clients in a variety of matters, including high-conflict divorce, child custody, and LGBTQ family law disputes. Along the way, she's amassed numerous honors and a sterling reputation as a counselor, advocate, and thought leader on family law, and in particular, LGBTQ family law issues. She's also served as a leader in numerous organizations, including on the board of the Colorado Women's Bar Association, as president of the Colorado LGBT Bar Association, and on the executive council of the family law section of the Colorado Bar Association. Rachel sat down with Linda Moss and Mallory Revel to talk about her path to the legal profession, her practice and advocacy work, and advice she would give to younger lawyers.
Hello and welcome to Our Voices. I'm Linda Moss. I'm a family law attorney with Coombe Curry Rich and Jarvis. I'm here with my co-host, Mallory Revel, who's a criminal defense attorney with Foster Graham, Milstein and Kalischer. And today we are joined by Rachel Catt of the Law Office of Rachel Catt. Hi, Rachel. How are you?
Hello, I'm well. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for agreeing to speak with us today. We're really excited to talk to you. So let's jump right in. Let's start with who were you? Who were you growing up?
Well, I grew up here in Colorado in Lafayette when it was a much smaller town than it is today. I was raised mostly by my mother, who had some health issues. She was sometimes a stay-at-home mom. Sometimes she worked as a paralegal. And my stepdad, who was a police officer. And my mother and dad had a very difficult divorce. And I was a product of a high-conflict divorce myself. So from a young age, I had an interest in the law because I could see how judges and attorneys influenced my own personal life in various ways.
I'm really curious, from your perspective as a family law attorney and myself as a family law attorney as well, I'm curious, what age were you when your parents got divorced?
5.
Okay. So what was your level of exposure or involvement to in their divorce?
My exposure level was very high.
Really?
Very high. Yeah, my mom did, I think, what a lot of moms did at that time. And we were in California at the time in the Los Angeles area. And my mother wanted to move home with her parents in Boulder. So she just packed us up and left. And they had what we would call now a parenting plan. I think my dad must have seen us weekends and maybe a midweek visit or something. And he came to pick us up and we were just gone. I think either she didn't understand that she was in contempt doing that, you know, but there certainly weren't the abduction prevention measures then that we have now. So she just was able to do that. And, you know, we've talked about it since then and she sort of regrets her behavior, but with the, you know, psychological supports or lack thereof that she had at the time, she felt like she was doing the right thing and felt like it was, you know, best and did not care for my dad one bit and let me know it.
Mm-hmm.
Really had no understanding how harmful that would end up being for me and my sister.
It's always really, really hard even for older kids to be involved in a divorce and to be so young and to be so exposed. That must have been really hard.
Yeah, it was not awesome start. It really wasn't. And, the good news is my dad and I were able to reconnect when I got to college, when I got out of the house. I mean, we have a wonderful relationship now and my kids have a wonderful relationship with him. And I tell him all the time that my family law clients could probably credit him with my nearly 20-year family law career.
Wow.
Law attorneys, usually at the 5 or 10 year mark, kind of have a come to Jesus with the practice of family law, for lack of a better term, and decide whether or not to stay in the field or not, if they really are truly passionate and dedicated to it. And that's probably where my dedication comes from, my own journey with being separated from my dad and then reuniting with him and seeing how my particular circumstances negatively impacted me and hoping that I can steer even the angriest parents away from the same fate and harming their children in the same way. Because, you know, like I said, I know my mom regrets it. And if she were able to do it differently now, she would. And I hope to give that opportunity to other parents.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get back into your childhood a little bit. So you were the product of a tough, tough divorce. Tell us a little bit more. What was it like, you know, in high school, college?
I was real nerdy in high school. I loved, I'm not sporty at all, but I loved the play. I loved theater. I loved the speech and debate team. More mm-hmm. speeches, less debating, honestly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed high school. I was real dorky that way. Then I went to Boulder, to CU Boulder for college, and enjoyed that as well.
Mm-hmm. What did you major in college?
Political science and women's studies.
Oh, awesome. Okay. So you were pretty well geared for law school, even if you hadn't already decided you were going to go to law school, with majors in political science and women's studies.
Yeah. I was ticked off about the injustices in the world. Mm-hmm. Women's studies sort of allowed me to pursue that, and very curious about politics, and mm-hmm. so studied that area as well.
And I know you did some activism around that time. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, if I can remember. I remember I did a hunger strike for women's violence or something. Mm-hmm. I was not out yet. I did not know I was gay for most of college. Mm. I came out my senior year of college on a study abroad trip to Mexico. Actually, I needed to get far away from home to be able to come out to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I came back home and graduated, I held off on my plans to go to law school and spent the next 2 years practicing being gay, I called it. I moved to Capitol Hill and volunteered at legal advocacy organizations. I did an internship at the Colorado State Legislature, worked at the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless, and just kind of explored my newly outed self, and thoroughly enjoyed that period of my life.
Awesome. I was going to ask how it went. It sounds like it went pretty well.
It was very fun. That was very fun.
I guess it's really interesting. I kind of had the same experience where I didn't really come out to myself until I moved very far away from home. And then I was like, I guess I've already known this. But
there's something freeing about being a little geographically diverse than you have been growing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just being on your own and figuring things out for yourself.
You know, it was scary to come back because Amendment 2 passed when I was a freshman in college. So mm-hmm. it was not really a warm, welcoming environment in Colorado to come out at that time. It was mm-hmm. sort of terrifying. The good news is those 2 years, you know, I think LGBT people who would not ordinarily have been activists felt under the gun, and they felt the pressure, and they felt scrutinized. And so mm-hmm. people were willing to come out and really rally as a community and advocate and organize. And it was a wonderful time actually to come out, as it turned out.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
So I guess you said you went to college, you spent the next couple of years being gay and getting involved. So what happened after that?
And then Julie Tolleson, I would consider her a mentor. She's currently at the AG's office, but she was the executive director of the Colorado Legal Initiatives Project at the time, which was an LGBT impact organization. She encouraged me to go to law school after all, as well as a couple of other folks. So I did apply, retook the LSAT, and went to the best law school I could get into, which was GW. Mm-hmm. I was very curious about politics, so I thought DC would be a cool place to go.
Yeah, for sure. How was law school for you?
Terrible. I did not enjoy one day of law school.
Who did? Student. We keep asking the same question.
I feel like this has been a
and
trend.
And everyone just says terrible.
Yeah.
I don't know who enjoys law school. We're going to find someone, but we have not found that person yet.
I know who the person is. But anyway, yeah, we've had this trend among a couple of our interviewees who are amazing attorneys, amazing, you know, judicial officers, who say that law school was just a nightmare. So tell us about it.
I didn't enjoy it. As it turned out, I was able to coast through college more than I had realized. It turned out law school was really important to actually read the material, attend the courses.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my first torts exam being in the bathroom thinking, I don't really understand what a tort is exactly. Not sure what I'm doing here. I left in the middle and got a coffee across the street. Thought about whether or not I should quit law school at that time.
Wow.
Came back, finished the exam, and, you know, passed somehow or other.
Wow.
Sort of towards the end of law school, I sort of got the hang of it. But no, I did not particularly enjoy my law school experience. I know there are people that do enjoy it, but I was not one of those people.
Did you go into law school knowing what kind of law you wanted to practice?
Yes, I thought so. I wanted to do advocacy for LGBT people and women. I wanted to save the LGBT community and women. That's what I thought I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any idea of particularly how you were going to go about that?
No, I did not. And then when I graduated, I took the bar in California and moved to San Francisco, where, as it turned out, the LGBT people and women were largely saved already.
Already saved. So you moved to San Francisco. You decided, I'm going to take the hardest bar in the country and move to San Francisco.
Yeah, I always thought I'd come home to Colorado, but I wasn't quite ready to come home. So I sort of randomly chose California. I knew a few people out there and just showed up.
How was the California bar?
It was the same as the Colorado bar, but it was longer. At that time, it was 3 days instead of 2 days. Mm-hmm. It had more topics to be covered. And I think that there's a wider, I mean, in Colorado, it's largely CU and DU kids that take the bar exam, whereas in California, it's a wide range of people taking it. This is just my theory. I have no proof of this is true or not. But they have an apprenticeship program in Colorado, in California, where people don't go to law school at all, you know, clear up to like Stanford Law. So there's a wide range of folks taking it. So the pass rate, I think, is low, I think, because of endurance, because it's 3 days, because there's a wide range of folks who are taking the test.
Interesting.
I think that's why the pass rate is
so low. The Kim Kardashians of the world can get on the bar exam.
Does Kim Kardashian have a law degree now?
You know, I'm not sure, but I know the California bar was where she was going to take the bar because you don't have to have that law degree.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's something. Okay, so you took the California bar, you passed the California bar, and you got a job.
I did. I tried really hard to get a job doing anything other than family law. I applied at legal advocacy organizations, but those I was competing with folks from Stanford and Harvard and people who did much better at law school than I did, so that wasn't going to work. I tried working in legal aid, same thing. I just wasn't qualified. Like, it was a tough job market at the time. The economy was not in great shape at that time. And, you know, I was competing against very few jobs, very well qualified applicants. Mm-hmm. And I accidentally took a family law clinic in law school. It was called the Civil and Family Litigation Clinic, which I thought meant you got to choose civil or family litigation, but it was just a misnomer. It was just a family law clinic. So accidentally did family law for a year in law school. So that was on my resume. And my other great mentor, Lori Nachlis, I was just sending cold resumes out to firms. And she saw this on my resume about the family law clinic and called me in for an interview. And she had this way of staring at people. And if she stared at you long enough, people would just blurt out the truth of the matter. She would use it on employees. She would totally use it on me in the interview. And I ended up saying, I don't know if I even want to be a lawyer. And I thought two things at once. A, I'm so not getting this job. And B, it feels really good to tell the truth. What am I going to do? I think I'm not going to be a lawyer. But instead, she leaned back in her chair, probably for a solid minute, staring at me and nodding, and finally said, I think I could use you. And she was just that enigmatic the whole time I worked there.
Wow. Very
talented at giving me exactly the right kind of work to keep me interested, but without, that would not cause me to run away. Huh. So for example, I would write these long, pretty decent briefs, but I refused to sign them and she didn't make me. And she didn't make me to court because I just wasn't going to, but eventually I did go to court and started doing cases on my own. And she was just very patient and gentle with me and really taught me everything I know about how to be a family law attorney.
Why didn't you want to sign the briefs that you put the work into?
I was just afraid. I was intimidated by the process. I think that law school had so thoroughly broken me down. My self-confidence was pretty well in the drain by the time I graduated. And I had tons of imposter syndrome, just didn't believe I was good enough to be there, that I should be there, that I wasn't smart enough, et cetera.
What helped you get that confidence back?
Yeah.
She went on vacation. She was so dedicated to her work that the only way she could stop thinking about it is if she scuba dived in the middle of nowhere where no one could find her when she was below the sea with like manta rays.
Yeah.
So you could not reach her when she was on vacation. And clients called me and asked me questions and I had to make decisions and do things. And I wasn't sure if I should or could. I was sure I was making mistakes. So I came back and she came back like, I'm sorry, but the people called. I had to do all this stuff. And she did her like slow nodding thing again and said, now you're acting like a lawyer. Oh, that's what it is. Okay. maybe I can do this.
That seems extremely important, that kind of affirmation. And I'm curious, did you learn any other, you know, major lessons from her that have stuck with you as you've continued with the practice of family law?
Yeah, I think the major lesson I learned from her is client control. She just had her own views and convictions. And if the clients were not in alignment with her, she just simply would not represent them.
Okay.
So she had very strong boundaries in that way. So for example, in her fee agreement, she had a clause that she would not take positions that she felt were contrary to the best interests of the client's children.
Mm-hmm.
And if they did not like that, they could get a new lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And she would really work with people. I mean, in initial interviews, she would ask people, tell me what first attracted you to your spouse, and get them talking about what they did at one time like about their spouse, and point out, this is probably how your children see them.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
So that's how we would begin to work with the most alienating, egregious parents and try to get them on the right track with their kids.
Yeah. That.
So that even really if they screwed up their marriages so far and their parenting so far, at least going forward, they could proceed with some kind of grace and respect for their co-parent and their children.
How perceptive.
Yeah. Did you see the effect of that? Did you find that it was effective in those cases?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Between her truth serum and her like, little mind games like that, people knew not to diss their ex in front of her ever.
Like,
she just wouldn't tolerate it.
Did she teach you the stare?
Oh, I hope so.
I've mastered it. I've tried and tried. I've never quite mastered it.
The truth stare. Oh, I think that's something we all need to learn.
Yeah,
the
she's
worst
something else.
Feeling when a client says something, you're like, I don't think that's true. So you worked for, and I'm sorry, tell me her name again.
Lori Nackless.
Lori Nackless.
Called Nackless and Fink.
Yeah. How long did you work for her?
4 years.
And what'd you do after that?
And then I started my own practice, which was great because I sort of practiced probably 3/4 time and shut my practice down twice to have kids. So I got married to my wife during that time and had our 2 kiddos, and it was wonderful to have the freedom and flexibility to be doing divorces. And, I was fortunate the right kind of work came to me at that time, which were pretty simple divorces that didn't take a lot of emotional work to do, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
So I could get them done and also have teeny tiny kids at home.
Did you
leave at 2 to go pick them up from daycare, stuff like that.
Mm. And I assume you and your spouse were together while you were still working for Ms. Nackless, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got together towards the end of my time at Lori's office. Yeah, we were together when I started my firm.
Did you have any struggles at the time when you were having children? And I assume you were having to, you know, take time away from work to, you know, care for the kids or any part of that process?
I think being a solo at that time was very conducive, at least for me, being a solo family law attorney to having kids. Because, I mean, there was, other than my clients, there was no one really to be upset if I was leaving early or whatever. So in between my partner and I, we were able to make ends meet and I could work less and she worked a little more and I did more of the childcare and we were just able to figure it out.
Did you have any struggles maintaining your practice?
No, like I said, I shut it down altogether for 6 months for both kids and then just didn't take any big heavy duty cases. I think I had one case that ended up having a 2-day trial in San Jose. That was a big fiasco. But other than that, during that whole probably 6-year period, I didn't have any big trials at all. I will also say I would find in California, at least the Bay Area in particular, it's much less litigious. I go to court a lot more here than I ever did in California. I've had to learn a lot of trial skills here that I just never used there.
Do you have any guesses of why that is?
Yep. In San Francisco and Marin in particular counties, they have a mandatory settlement conference with the court that you have to attend. And the way they set it up is before you're permitted to have a trial date, you have to have a settlement conference with 2 certified family law specialists, or if it's a kid case, it'll be a certified family law specialist and a psychologist.
Oh.
And you give them basically what we would call a JTMC and all your supporting documents. You have to provide it. You faxed it to them the Friday before. And then you'd go in Monday morning and they would assess your case with everyone in the room, both counsels and both clients. And they would say, listen, this is where your case is strong. This is where it's weak. We're going to give you some ideas on how you can settle this. And then you had 3 hours. It was a 3-hour process from 9 to noon. It was very high pressure. Everyone was super prepped. And 99% of cases, I don't think I'm exaggerating, pretty close. And the 90% of cases would completely settle.
Wow.
And the ones that didn't had like 1 or 2 discrete issues that you would end up trying almost always by offer of proof. And direct exams, if everyone agreed, could be in writing. So it would just be an affidavit. Your whole direct exam was just an affidavit that you would submit in advance. And then the opposing counsel would give you notice if you wanted to cross-examine them. So it like totally cut down the length of the hearings. And I never did any direct exams ever.
Wow.
Wow. That's remarkable.
Yeah. Vastly different from what we have here.
Yeah.
Did you find that those proceedings were comparatively less expensive for clients than the typical proceeding here where you're, you know, litigating, going to a full hearing, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I'd say they were less expensive and they were less dramatic and the clients were less likely to sort of screw up their own cases by talking. Mm-hmm. So they would, so how I would do it is they would talk to me and I would type.
Yeah.
So it would just come out better because I could edit it. It was all true and factual. You know how you get a client on the stand, you don't know what they're going to say.
Yeah, or you think you know what they're going to say, and then they pop out with something totally mysterious that you had no idea was coming.
Not having any experience in family law, do you think that that system is something that could potentially be implemented in Colorado at some point?
I don't see why not. I think it worked well. I thought it worked really well. Coming here, I mean, I say to colleagues in San Francisco, in some ways this feels like the Wild West to me. There's more money in California and there are more people. So there are more appealed cases. So there's vastly more case law and the statutory scheme I found to be more streamlined and less sort of confusing. You know, I think I'm probably going to get in some hot water here, but I think that the judicial training was more robust and earlier in the careers of the judicial officer. My understanding is here there's a week-long training, but a judge could be on the bench for up to a year before they ever get the training. Whereas I believe this is true, maybe in all of California, certainly in the Bay Area, they would have 1 or 2 weeks specifically on domestic law before they took the domestic bench. And we just don't have that here. So these poor judges get dropped in almost always first to family law without almost always without any family law background at all. And it's a complicated area of law.
Yeah.
Folks just don't really realize that till they're thrown in the hot seat.
And this is a great opportunity for us to start talking about the now, who you are now. You moved back to Colorado, obviously. When did you move back to Colorado?
We moved back to Colorado in 2013. We wanted to raise our children around our families. My wife is also from Colorado, so.
Cool. And you started working for Harrington, Brewster & Klein.
I did. I worked for those gals also for about 4 years, I think, before going out on my own here in Denver a year ago.
How did you wind up with their practice?
I had Carrie Klein as an opposing counsel. And she liked me and I liked her. And she suggested, she said, you know, I'm going to be leaving the firm soon. There's going to be an opening. You might want to call. And see if they'll take you. So I call and met with them and we had lunch and hit it off and they asked me to join their firm.
So you hit it off with Harrington, Brewster & Klein. Tell us about the experience of that firm, because I know that they are kind of a unique type of firm in Colorado because they focus on collaboration, which is very much in line with what you were just talking about in California. So tell us about their firm a little bit.
Right. So Terry Harrington and Cindy Brewster really are, you know, probably the foremothers or grandmothers, or they probably won't like me saying that, of collaborative law in Colorado. Really got the ball rolling here in many ways, and are still very active in the collaborative law community, which, for those of you who don't know, is a way to get divorced without going to court. The parties and attorneys agree that they will not litigate, and they have a different process, which is, you know, essentially a series of meetings, but where participants, parties, are allowed to work outside the box a little bit more. They're allowed to consider each other's needs. In addition to, you know, simply what the court might order, you could think about, okay, but for our family and our circumstances, what really makes sense and what's really fair and what can we live with? Mm-hmm. So it's a wonderful process for folks who are willing to give it a try. So Terry and Cindy at this point don't litigate anymore at all. They only mediate and take collaborative cases. Mm-hmm. And then, at least at the time I was working for them, they had three associates who would take the litigation cases.
Got it. So you moved back to Colorado. Have you had any other opportunities to save the women and the gays since you've been here?
Yep. I immediately got involved with the Colorado LGBT Bar Association. Mm-hmm. And within a year or so, I was probably on their board. I've been serving on their board since 2014 or 2015, and was the 2019 president of the LGBT Bar Association.
Awesome.
I founded their public policy committee. Hmm. And so for the last several years, I've always sent attorneys to provide the perspective of the LGBT community and our view of the law and how the proposed statute would fit into the legal framework.
Have you seen the effects of that presence?
Definitely. I find, I believe that organizations that oppose us know that we're going to be there and tailor their testimony accordingly. Mm. I also find that because we're attorneys speaking, that the legislators tend to have ask us questions and have some confidence that what we're saying is probably legitimate and valid and something that they can consider.
Important.
But I love going to those hearings, and organizing volunteers to go to those hearings is a great opportunity for law students. Anybody can go. Young lawyers, old lawyers, every kind of lawyer or student, any member of our organization can go and testify. It's only 3 minutes of testimony, so they can get through it.
What kind of preparation goes into preparing for that?
If it's a national bill, like, for example, the anti-conversion therapy bill was a national movement, so we had talking points from the national LGBT organization that we could use and start from there. Mm-hmm. And then we do our own research as we're sitting there, Colorado-specific research.
Mm-hmm. Have you actually had law students participate and go to these hearings?
I'm trying to think. They have been invited. They've shown interest. I think maybe one or two has come to testify. We've definitely had young lawyers, mm-hmm. who I think were going through that imposter syndrome phase of their career. And I always hope it was a good ego boost for them to have sat in front of the legislator and presented a position to them.
Yeah. It seems like a really intimidating role.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they've been generally successful.
What insight would you share with someone who's thinking about getting involved in leadership in a specialty bar? Based on your experience and your presidency, what would you share with someone?
Show up. Just show up. In a demographic like Denver, as opposed to New York or DC or San Francisco, if you show up, there is work to do, and there is plenty of work to do. So if you have a mission, if you have a passion, if you have a bill that you want passed, if you have an issue that you just think needs fixing, just show up and start doing the work, and there are folks who will help you. And there is a place for you to do that work. So come to our meetings, come to our events. Someone will rope you into leadership. It will happen for you.
Can you think of any qualities that you would associate with the best leaders of, you know, the bar associations or any of these organizations that, you know, others should aspire to? Aside from showing up.
I think specificity of vision. So like I said, if you have a specific issue that you find troubling, mm-hmm. and coalition building, being willing to take the time to talk to as many people as you can, as many stakeholders as you can, to get their input. And thirdly, I would say encouragement. You know, people mm-hmm. are doing this on a volunteer basis. You know, they're they're spending their valuable free time working on an issue for the community. And it's amazing what how far a little compliment can go in encouragement, getting people to continue doing the work.
And you've mentioned imposter syndrome a few times. And every time you have, for the listeners, Linda and I have been kind of aggressively nodding as you've commented on that. For anyone who doesn't know what that is, can you explain that a little bit and talk about the role, if any, that's had in your career or younger lawyers that you've worked with?
Well, maybe there's a more technical definition, but the way I think of it is just the sense that for whatever reason, you're not good enough and you're not meant to be there. And from what I've heard, particularly hanging around the Women's Bar Association, this happens particularly to women, young women, people of color, LGBT folks, anyone who's marginalized. It seems to happen less to straight, cis, white men who sort of feel like they're supposed to be there. Like they look like what a lawyer is supposed to look like, right? Mm-hmm. And so for the rest of us, when we get there, they don't realize, you know, like no one knows what they're doing. Like they don't really teach you how to be a lawyer in law school. Nobody tells you that. Nobody knows what they're doing when they first get out. It's very rare. And everyone is sort of faking it for a while. Mm-hmm.
So what would your advice be to a young lawyer who's currently feeling like they're faking it?
That is normal. And fake it till you make it is a perfectly fine way to practice law until you feel like you're not faking it anymore. And it just takes time and experience and enough times of faking it and actually getting a decent result for your client to start to believe, oh, maybe I can do this. And then that imposter syndrome will go away. But that feeling of not, that sense of feeling like you're not supposed to be there, don't let that stop you from being there. Just walk through it anyway. Just do it anyway. Mm. Do it anyway and enough times of doing it anyway, and that feeling will go away.
Yeah. That's great advice.
Yeah. So I would love to talk a little bit about how your advocacy and also just your knowledge of the issues facing LGBT people has affected your practice, because you're a family law attorney. And so obviously you know, see LGBT issues just in the course of your practice.
Mm-hmm. Can you be more specific?
Yeah. So do you have clients who identify as LGBT, and what kinds of issues have you seen in those cases that are different from the issues that arise in, you know, non-LGBT cases?
I do. I'd say probably on a regular basis, about a third of my practice of my clientele are LGBT. Mm-hmm. let me think of issues. So I have an ongoing post-decree parentage issue that will just probably go on till these kids are 18, where the dad was transgender. That issue comes up mostly with the court not knowing what to do with pronouns necessarily. With the mom making some transphobic comments from time to time, trying to bring that to the attention of the court. Mm-hmm. I tend to just assume that the judge is on our side and they know that, you know, making slurs about someone's transgender status is not indicative of the parent promoting love and respect between the children and the other parent.
Right.
We're one of the few states, we have a case from the 70s in Colorado that specifically says that transgender status cannot be used as a factor in making a best interest decision for parentage, mm-hmm. Unless you can show that the transgender status is somehow specifically harming the child or interfering right. with the person's ability to parent, which right. almost never happens.
Right.
So in that way, that has come up. The issue of same-sex retroactive common law marriage comes up a lot.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Right. So here's an example. I had two women who were, I've had this case several times with women and men, where they acted like they were married and behaved like they were married well before the Obergefell decision came out, or in Colorado mm-hmm. it was really the Kitchen decision the year before. Mm-hmm. So can you have such a thing as a common law marriage prior to marriage being a thing? You can have it, I think. Right now that case is pending at the Colorado Supreme Court. Could come out any day, whether or not you can have a same-sex retroactive common law marriage prior to Obergefell. I think that the United States constitutional law jurisprudence is really clear on that, that you can, that it is retroactive. When a law is found to be unconstitutional, it's void ab initio. You have to pretend like it never existed. Mm-hmm. So we're in this weird predicament of we have to pretend like there never was a one man, one woman law on the books mm-hmm. in Colorado, mm-hmm. you know, but then to prove a common law marriage, the people had to hold themselves out as husband and wife.
Right.
So the first thing you have to do is get the judge to hopefully make the obvious leap of taking out husband and wife. Mm-hmm. But then many of them are stuck on, so then did you call each other wife and wife? And I don't know about you, Linda, but I don't really call my wife, because I think it's weird. Because I was a women's studies major, and I didn't want to be a wife, and I never wanted to have a wife, and I think it's a patriarchal construct. I don't really want any wives in my life. So that's why I said it, not because I was any less of a wife, but because I don't like the idea of wives, really.
Right.
I think a lot of older lesbians feel that way. A lot of older LGBT people don't say husband and wife. It just feels weird to us. It felt fake. Mm-hmm. So many people say partner. Not everybody says partner. There's a whole sect of people who say lover. Like, it kind of creeps me out, but they insist on calling each other lovers. I'm like, that's like bedroomy, but okay, if you want. And they think it's fine. They love them. It's like, okay, it's fine.
Right.
I did this whole sort of survey when I was trying to figure out how to prove common law marriage cases for gay people. I just called a bunch of gay people. I was like, okay, what do you think it would take for your thing that you're in, that you do in your life, to count as a marriage? Like, what would count? Uh-huh. And I asked them, they were so interesting, their answers. Some people said, definitely, if you say partner, that for sure means married. Somebody else said, oh no, I call all my boyfriends partner. I hope I'm not married to all of them. So it really varies. Uh-huh. Jewelry is interesting. Lots of gay people did not wear wedding rings on their left hand. Mm-hmm. There's lots of wedding rings on the right hand, or there were pinky rings, or there's tattoos, or there are necklaces. Or Edie Windsor in the Windsor case proposed with a diamond brooch to avoid unwanted questioning from people at work, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and that opens up a whole other can of worms too. If you're, you know, not out, and so you want to be proposing, or you want to be out with your spouse or your partner, but you can't do it in such a way that heterosexual people might do it, because it's going to tip everyone in your life off. So it even creates a further barrier to proving yourself.
I had a case where two women lived together, but to hide the fact that they were lesbians in a relationship, they had separate landlines with their own phone numbers to try to conceal the fact that they were lovers, partners, wives, whatever, living together.
Wow. Separate landlines. What year was this?
It was in the 80s.
Okay. I don't know what that would prove now, except that you're spending a lot of money on your phone bill. But that's a really interesting measure to take to avoid suspicion. Oh, yeah. And this is an utterly fascinating issue that I could talk about for probably hours, but we're going to run out of time. So I want to ask you about who you want to be, who you will be next. And so I know that you've opened your own practice about a year ago. So tell us a little bit about what your practice is and what you see it being.
So right now I have mostly litigated cases. Lots of funky parentage issues with aunts and uncles and grandparents in it. Mm-hmm. Some domestic violence restraining orders, plenty of run of the mill straight people getting divorced with kids and pensions and businesses, that normal kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I have also started a PCDM practice. For those who don't know, is a, parenting coordinator and decision-making practice. Because I find litigation personally exhausting, and I don't know if you can see it, but I think every gray hair I've gotten in the last 5 years, I can attribute 2 or 3 to every day spent in trial. So
fair.
I am exhausted of that, and I don't think it's the healthiest way to resolve family conflict. So I'm really making an effort in the next few years to move away from me personally being in the courtroom and litigating, and instead doing more of the neutral practice. So the PCDM, I've taken a mediation training. I'm starting to take mediation clients. Mm-hmm. And we'll get more back involved in the collaborative law world with Terry and Cindy, and take that route. Having said that, some cases do need to be litigated. And I hope to bring on an associate this year, maybe someone LGBT, but certainly an ally, who I can train hopefully in the same way that Lori Nackless trained me to be an authentic, compassionate, but powerful, dedicated litigator to help folks who really do need that. And I always try like hell to resolve my cases outside of court. You just never know how things are going to go in a family law courtroom. If that doesn't work, it doesn't work. So I hope to train someone who is not so tired as me, who wants someone to be in the courtroom, how to do that in the next year and move my own practice more to a neutral practice. I will always continue to do the novel LGBT cases. Those I would still litigate, whether it's in the Court of Appeals or writing an amicus brief or taking on a novel issue that could create law in Colorado for LGBT people. I'll always continue to do those, paid or pro bono, whatever works.
What do you mean by novel issues exactly?
So for example, the on this retroactive same-sex common law marriage issue, the Edie Hogsett case, I was on the team for her Court of Appeals pro bono, specifically on the issue of judge, how do we figure this out? In the lower court, the trial judge specifically asked for guidance. How do I figure this out? How do I figure out if someone had an intention to be married during a time when they were impermissibly denied the right to be married? How? And then I switched gears for the Supreme Court and helped coordinate the amicus briefing for the LGBT Bar Association and the family law section. A few other groups provided amicus briefing, plus both parties, on how the court should redefine or restructure or in some way adjust our definitions of common law marriage in Colorado. If we're going to keep common law marriage, it needs to be applicable to all families and all couples.
Right.
So I'll be excited to see how they decide that.
So how do you see LGBT family law evolving in Colorado? And I know that's a vast question, but anything you can think of.
You know, right now I'm getting lots of questions about adoptions and whether or not people need to adopt their own children, even if they're on their birth certificate. I would say that they do.
Why is
that? Because, well, you know, the United States Supreme Court has made signals even in the last couple of weeks. At least two of the justices are not happy with the Obergefell decision and think that it impinges on religious freedom for certain Americans. I'm pretty certain that our current candidate for the Supreme Court will be appointed, and I'm pretty certain she probably doesn't love Obergefell any more than Scalia did. So I don't know that same-sex marriage will be overturned altogether, but I think that there's a pretty decent chance that those rights will be impinged on in some way. So lots of people are calling me, asking me, you know, are my parentage rights secure? And they're not, and they never were, quite frankly. Unless you have an adoption or a judgment of parentage, no one's parental rights are secure. You have a presumption of parentage if you're biologically related, if you're married to the person who gave birth to your child, if you held the child out as your own and called them your child, you have a presumption. Like, we all have presumptions, but you don't really know your kid is your kid for sure legally unless you have an adoption or a judgment of parentage. So I think all people should get adoptions. California and New Jersey have a process called confirmatory adoptions, which my understanding is that it's a simpler, less expensive way for LGBT folks to adopt their own children to just avoid all this in the future. This is going to prevent your problems in emergency rooms. If you want to see your kid in the emergency room, if there's an inheritance issue with you, if you die, things like that. So that's one issue that's up for sure right now.
So it sounds like family law is just better in California overall.
That's the takeaway. Everyone should go practice family law in California.
Yeah. And live.
I enjoyed it and I learned a lot. I hope to bring some of those bright ideas here.
Well, what's next for you personally?
Personally, I hope COVID ends someday so my children can go back to school. That would be great, not having to manage homeschool and run a law practice at the same time. I think honestly, we're just trying to survive the COVID school. I have a kid who's going to be a teenager soon. Just parenting and trying to enjoy that as best I can and adjust my practice a little bit so it's a little bit less stressful. Get me and my clients and my kids through this COVID time.
Yeah, it's really hard to think past COVID, isn't it?
How do you practice self-care in COVID?
I do several things. I take walks in the morning whenever I can for half an hour. I started listening to free meditation apps, and I listen to them before I get out of bed, before I turn on the lights, and before my feet touch the floor. Someone said the only way to do meditation wrong is to not do it. So that's how I do it. I do not sit on a cushion. I'm not calm. I do not do anything they say, except I listen to it while I'm lying there. And it does definitely set the tone for the day, and I feel calmer. I've started going to an Eastern Western medical practitioner person. So in addition to having normal medications, I also take lavender oil pills each day in the morning and the evening. which I don't know if they help or not, but I feel like they help me, so I take them.
Perfect. It sounds soothing.
Yes. Have purchased many, many Himalayan rock salt lamps, which I have put everywhere. There's one by my office desk. There's one in my bedroom. I'm giving them out to my clients. I'm giving them out to my friends. I gave one to my neurologist. I give them to everyone. I don't know if they work or not. I feel like they are calming my chi and everyone else's. And that is what I need.
Yeah.
These are some great tips. I'm taking notes here.
These are excellent
tips.
The way to live an amazingly zen life in the middle of COVID. That's awesome.
I do think, I mean, joking aside, it does serve as a reminder to take a breath and have grace and patience in this extremely screwed up time.
Awesome. Well, I think we are at our time, so we're going to have to wrap up our interview, but this has been just so much fun to talk to you, and Mallory's signaling to everyone out in the other room. But yeah, so thank you so much, Rachel, for taking the time to speak with us and to tell us how to live a perfectly zen lifestyle, overcome imposter syndrome.
So many lessons.
Yeah, maybe someday we'll all learn how to do the truth stare. It's been so much fun, and we've learned so much from talking to you. So thank you so much
for
your time.
Thank you so much, Rachel. This has been such a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
This has been Our Voices. For more information on today's guest or to get involved, please check out the CBA podcast page at cobar.org/podcast. That's cobar.org/podcast. This podcast series was created by members of the Colorado and Denver Bar Associations. Our Voices is a collaborative effort of the EDI Joint Steering Committee messaging team, including Mallory Revel, Linda Moss, Bonnie Schreiner, Mallory Hasbrook, Mo Watson, Mario Trimble, Courtney Holm, and Emmy Lopez, with our CBA Communications Team Director, Heather Folker, and Manager, Charles McGarvey. Our recording engineer is Rick Pontellion of Lionsbridge Recording. Our producer and editor is Courtney Holm, with theme and introduction by Mario Trimble. This podcast is made possible because of the support of the Colorado and Denver Bar Associations. On behalf of all of us, thanks for listening to Our Voices.